Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 26th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's begin, as usual, with the weather. Today, sunny. An easterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, with a high of 76 and a low of 48. Tomorrow, sunny, with a southeasterly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow's high is 79 and the low 53. Come Sunday, mostly sunny with an easterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Expect a high of 83 and a low of 56. On Monday, mostly sunny, a southerly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour, a high of 84 and a low of 60. Sunset tonight will be at 8:31. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:36. Today, we will have 14 hours and 54 minutes of daylight. Today's top weather story is from meteorologist Jan Reihard. Jan says the latest drought monitor was released Thursday morning. There were minor changes to parts of Wapello, Davis, and Van Buren counties in far southeast Iowa, which saw an increase in the area as D1 or moderate drought. Outside of this, there was negligible changes in eastern Iowa, where areas of DO remain. It is important to remember first that the drought monitor accounts for rain from Tuesday to Tuesday prior to release, in this case, May 16th through 23rd. With dry weather since then and likely to continue, the intensification is increasingly likely. As of May 22nd through 25th, 25% of the state's topsoil was rated short or very short, while 71% was rated adequate. 95% of the state's expected corn crop and 84% of the state's expected soybean crop has been planted. And that's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard. Now on to the news. And on the front page today is a story written by Tom Barton of the Gazette's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Ahead of what airlines say could be the busiest Memorial Day weekend for travel since before the pandemic, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg stopped at the Eastern Iowa Airport to highlight federal investments he said will make for a better passenger experience and support job growth. He also stopped in Dubuque on Thursday to see how that city is using federal infrastructure funding to remove an up at at-grade crossing and build a railroad overpass in the city. Buttigieg made history as the first openly gay man to launch a competitive campaign for president, and also criticized Republican state lawmakers for misplaced priorities in passing legislation targeting LGBTQ Iowans. Asked about state legislatures in red states, including Iowa, passing a number of anti-LGBTQ bills, Buttigieg said states trying to roll back LGBTQ rights aren't helping anybody. He said, "We're going to continue focusing on the work we can do, by the way, often on a bipartisan basis. That's making people better off and delivering concrete results." He said the Biden administration is in Cedar Rapids trying to make life easier for airline passengers, while in Des Moines, quote, they're making life harder for LGBTQ high schoolers. He said, of all the things you could do with the power and the trust and the resources put in your hands as an elected official, why wouldn't you be concentrating more on building roads and bridges and fixing up airports and making insulin more affordable and helping veterans and all the other things we're doing as an administration? He said, we're going to continue focusing on the work we can do, by the way, often on a bipartisan basis, that's making people better off and delivering concrete results. Calling Midwest the cradle of aviation innovation in the world, Buttigieg said the nation has been slipping through a lack of investment over decades. He said, since the 1980s, we have been needing to do more, whether it's our airports, our roads, our bridges, our transit rails, and ports. And thanks to President Biden and the bipartisan leaders from both sides of the aisle, we're doing it. Buttigieg toured the fourth and final phase of the Cedar Rapids Airport's terminal modernization to see federal infrastructure dollars at work. The $120.9 million project is funded in part by a $20 million grant made possible by the bipartisan infrastructure law championed and signed into law by Biden. Airport officials also received a $28 million state grant from the Iowa Commercial Aviation Fund. The $68 million fourth phase includes remodeling the rest of the terminal, adding 32,000 square feet and four additional jet bridges, building a larger patio with a license to serve alcohol, and adding a pet relief area and a sensory room for people overstimulated by travel. Construction began in early March and is estimated to take 18 to 24 months. When completed, the work will improve travel and passenger amenities, expand concourse space to accommodate larger planes, and position the airport to capitalize on growing demand and add flights. Buttigieg, city and airport officials said that yesterday. The 2021 infrastructure law put aside $25 billion for airports to address repair and maintenance backlogs, reduce congestion and emissions near ports and airports, and drive electrification and other low-carbon technologies. This was Buttigieg's first trip to Iowa as the Secretary of Transportation. According to a DOT staffer, Buttigieg won the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses. He said yesterday, "What we see here brings together a lot of the different things that we're trying to support. Making sure that, of course, we have the support for economic growth, a better passenger experience." Buttigieg said the new law provides more funding for terminal work for airports to upgrade bathrooms and concourse areas and provide for quicker, more efficient security screening and baggage claim process. He said, "What we've seen in the aviation sector is it's come roaring back faster than anybody thought. It's great news, but it's meant, obviously, a lot of stress on the system." Amid an ongoing air traffic controller shortage that's been partly to blame for disruptions across the system, Buttigieg said the Transportation Department continues to hire and train controllers even as key facilities remain below targets. Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said aviation and transportation long have been integral to Cedar Rapids' success, both past and present. She noted the city's deep-rooted connection to aviation history, mentioning that brothers Wilbur and Orville Wright lived in Cedar Rapids when they were young. O'Donnell also mentioned the communicating technology developed at what is now Collins Aerospace that connected NASA engineers with Apollo 11 astronauts on their historic lunar mission. O'Donnell said, "Cedar Rapids' economic strength relies heavily on this airport. The significant investment that we mark today will not only benefit the passengers, but also contribute to the flourishing commerce and certainly workforce development of our city." From its humble beginning 75 years ago, O'Donnell said, with a farmhouse serving as its terminal, our airport has evolved today into a facility we can all take pride in. Also on the front page today is a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, "Millions for Mental Health at Risk if Surplus Isn't Spent." Dateline, Hiawatha. County supervisors on the board that governs regional mental health and disability services advocated Thursday for spending down much of its nearly $9.2 million surplus before the end of the budget year next month, by boosting support for initiatives within its nine-county area to avoid the state withholding future funds. At the end of fiscal 2023, on June 30th, the East Central Mental Health Region Governing Board directed regional staff to draft a plan for how to spend part of the surplus, at least about $4.2 million that goes beyond the state-mandated fund balance, to better pay mental health care providers who are seeing high levels of demand for underfunded services. The Iowa Department of Health and Human Services allocates state property tax dollars to regions, but if regions carry too much of a surplus, the agency withholds further dollars. That essentially means providers within the region lose out on funding that would otherwise go toward enhancing services and addressing unmet local needs. State lawmakers require the regions to hold fund balances of 20%, but that will drop to 5% next fiscal year. Regional Chief Executive Officer May Hingen asked the board for direction at the board's meeting Thursday at the Kirkwood Regional Center on how to spend the fund balance or whether to let it remain as is. The region covers services in 9 counties: Benton, Bremer, Buchanan, Delaware, Dubuque, Iowa, Johnson, Jones, and Lynn. Johnson County Supervisor Rod Sullivan, who represents that county on the board, said, "These dollars are appropriated for the taxpayers of the region to have spent on people in the region who have the needs. I hear from people, certainly in my own county, that there's plenty of unmet need. So I think we should do what we can to get the money out the door." Dubuque County Supervisor Ann McDonough said it made her heart ache that the board had so much available to spend when there are millions of dollars needed on the ground that could be spent in partnership with providers. In recent months, supervisors pressed for more funding for the Lynn and Johnson County Mental Health Access Centers, anticipating that the region would end up holding a multi-million dollar surplus. The board passed a fiscal 2024 budget in March that allocated $2.9 million to the facilities, which is up from the initially proposed $2.5 million. County officials have said regional funding and low Medicaid reimbursement rates don't cover the cost of services, and for Lynn County, the resource gap is a barrier to the Access Center's expansion to be open around the clock. It's these kind of services and others, such as youth or homeless shelters, that supervisors are looking to better fund with the available surplus. McDonough said the region is being too conservative in the awards it makes, and there's not a follow-up process to reconsider increasing allocations. She and Lynn County Supervisor Ben Rogers took issue with the CEO Hingen's lack of recommendations for spending down the surplus, which McDonough said felt like a scramble to now allocate with only about 5 weeks to go. Rogers said this region could decide to be a model and opt to supplement the gap providers face from low Medicaid reimbursement rates. Rogers said, "We have so much in fund balance that's not being spent down, and now, by legislative decree, we have to surrender it. And we have surrendered it for last year. Now it's May 25th, and we're going to come back at the end of June asking for proposals from providers." Saddled with a surplus every year that's in excess of the state-mandated fund balance, the supervisors urged better financial planning to ensure the board isn't faced with the same issue in future years of having 1 month to figure out how to spend millions. McDonough said, "There has to be a solution to this that is sustainable. We cannot run into this brick wall year after year. We have so much money left at the end of the year when we know our communities, it is dry earth still, that there's not enough services." McDonough suggested forming a subcommittee of the board focused on finances. Deborah Seymour Gard, who is finance coordinator for the region, said there are a number of challenges involved with budget estimates. She said, "Sometimes providers aren't billing for services in a timely fashion, so it's impossible to accurately track how much is spent. Additionally, regional staff said sometimes services may not come to fruition until a later date than anticipated, throwing off providers' estimates." She suggested possibly boosting funding allocated to the Linn and Johnson County Medical Health Access Centers, which she estimated could spend down at least $2 million. Access hubs in Dubuque and Benton counties, which are not state-designated facilities and provide a smaller scope of services, could potentially get a boost as well. Supervisors indicated support for reviewing previous proposals that were not fully funded, particularly increasing allocations to the access centers and hubs. If the region opted not to further spend down its surplus, McDonnell said that would fuel lawmakers' arguments in the future to reduce the amount of funding for regions, hindering the board's ability to support ideas such as jail diversion and access centers. Also on the front page, a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette, No Evidence Two Killed the Taboo Were Targeted. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Linn County's top prosecutor says there was no evidence to show that Timothy Rush targeted his girlfriend and another man last year when he fatally shot them in the now-defunct Taboo nightclub and lounge, as the victims' families asserted earlier this week during Rush's sentencing. The investigation showed Rush fired a 9mm handgun indiscriminately into a crowd of people after Demione Walker, who was also in the club April 10, 2022, executed Michael Valentine moments earlier, sending the large crowd into a frenzy as clubgoers tried to get out of the downtown bar. That's what Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks told the Gazette. He said, "That is manslaughter. That is what the evidence supported, and that was the reason for the plea agreement. We didn't have evidence to support that this was targeted." Family members of victim Nicole Owens during sentencing said they believed it was no coincidence that the 35-year-old Owens and 31-year-old Marvin Cox of Cedar Rapids were fatally shot because Owens, who had a daughter with Rush, was attempting to leave him, and Cox was romantically interested in her. Rush was originally charged with two counts of second-degree murder. He pleaded in March to two counts of involuntary manslaughter, five counts of reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, and one count each of intimidation with a dangerous weapon and possession of a firearm by a felon. According to a criminal complaint and plea, Rush also shot Alasia Cotton and Michaela Stokes, causing them serious injuries, and Trenise Worley, Denise Triplett, and Richard Nixon, who suffered bodily injuries. A judge sentenced him Monday to 30 years in prison in accordance with a plea agreement. He was also ordered to pay $150,000 each in restitution to the heirs or estates of Owens and Cox. Maybanks said, "Our heart goes out to the families of the victim, and we acknowledge their pain and loss." He went on to say, according to the Cedar Rapids Police Department, family members of Nicole Owens were initially talked to, and there was no evidence to support that Mr. Rush targeted her. The evidence showed she was the unfortunate victim of his reckless impulse. "This was a difficult and tragic case that never should have happened," Maybank said. He added that Rush was apparently a part-time security employee for the club and carried a firearm, which he wasn't allowed to have because he has previous state and federal felony convictions. When Walker shot Valentine, Rush was on the other side of the club in the corner. Maybanks said he dropped down and started recklessly shooting into the crowd. Rush was shooting toward the gunfire as a reaction to Walker. There was no evidence that Rush and Walker knew each other or were working in concert that night, or that Rush had any specific intent to kill. A jury in November 2022 convicted Walker of first-degree murder, going armed with intent, and being a felon in possession of a firearm. He was sentenced to life in prison. Maybank said, "This wasn't well thought out. That's the risk of putting someone in a position like this to enforce security without the proper training." "It's still baffling," he said, "that so many people with guns, many of whom were prohibited, were allowed into this close space where alcohol was being served and security was minimal." Owen's family also alleged at the hearing that the investigation was lacking because police investigators didn't talk to all the family members, including three of Owen's sisters who were also at the club, and systemic issues that hinder justice for black people. Maybank said, "We absolutely disagree with any assertion that if the victims in this case were of a different race, that the result would be any different." He said, "Our office has a history of standing up on behalf of all victims, and race is never a factor in the evaluation of the evidence and reaching a disposition." He said family members were told about the plea agreement before it was made public. He or others in his office talked to family members or returned their calls throughout the case. Cedar Rapids police investigators told Maybanks they initially talked to the family after the shooting. If family members had information about a possible motive, like Rush being jealous of Owens and Cox, why didn't they come forward at the time? Maybanks said, "We can't look into something we don't know, but we didn't have evidence to support that." He said Assistant Linn County Attorney Mike Harris, who prosecuted the case, made the best decision possible for the victims and the community under these facts, and we support his decision. Maybank said this case, along with others, demonstrates the need in Iowa for a reckless homicide charge that would fall between second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter. Maybank said there is room in the middle for a charge that would have more adequately held Rush responsible, but we are bound by the statutes. As a member of the Legislative Committee for the Iowa County Attorneys Association, Maybank said he plans to propose for the next legislative session a new Class B charge of reckless homicide or third-degree murder, punishable by up to 25 years in prison. This, he said, would be comparable to vehicular homicide by intoxication. He said he would also like to see lawmakers decide if mandatory minimum terms are appropriate, either as the standard for all reckless homicides or when aggravating factors are involved, such as when a dangerous weapon is used or failure to contact authorities to render medical assistance. Maybank said this was a difficult and tragic case that never should have happened. Now let's take a gander at the Insight page, where we do have a Gazette editorial today. The headline says, "Veto the Child Labor Bill." The editorial says, "We thought the idea of loosening child labor laws in Iowa was a bad idea when it was floated this year. That view hasn't changed as it navigated the Republican-controlled legislature and made its way to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. Child labor laws were approved by past legislatures for good reasons. Too often, children working for little pay were put in physical danger and exploited by employers. Those working conditions affected their ability to get an education and tap other opportunities that go along with schooling. The laws have not stopped kids from working as a wide array of part-time jobs. Those reasons remain good enough for us, and we see no reason to backtrack. But another reason to oppose Iowa's child labor bill comes from the U.S. Department of Labor, which recently sent a letter to State House Democrats warning that some changes included in the bill could violate federal law. One part of the bill that would allow 14- and 15-year-olds to work until 9 p.m. during the school year and 11 p.m. in the summer runs counter to the federal limit of 7 p.m. Allowing those kids to work up to 28 hours weekly during the school year blows past the federal 18-hour limit. Permitting kids aged 14 and 15 to work in industrial laundries, meat freezers, and at light assembly work also could be problematic, according to the Labor Department. The bill provides liability protection for businesses that hire kids, but no new protections for the workers. We've seen instances across the country this year of kids as young as 13 working in meatpacking plants in Nebraska and Kansas, and 10-year-olds working at a Louisville McDonald's until 2 a.m., among other examples of exploitation. Republicans say the Labor Department has it all wrong. Their weakest argument is that some labor laws on the books in Iowa don't meet federal standards. Then those laws need to be strengthened. and the Biden administration deserves credit for putting new resources into enforcing the law as several red states seek to weaken child labor protections. Reynolds should veto the bill, and then members of both parties should turn their attention to finding more constructive ways to prepare kids for the workforce, such as more apprenticeships, school-based vocational training, and other models that don't require putting kids at risk. And that's today's Cedar Rapids Gazette editorial. We also have a guest editorial from Joe Bolcom, former Democratic State Senator from Iowa City. The headline to his editorial says, Reynolds fails to protect Iowa workers. Mr. Bolcom says, why was Governor Kim Reynolds the only Iowan to be surprised that a company trying to turn roofing shingles into diesel fuel would require a poisonous mix of toxic, dangerous chemicals? And why wasn't it obvious to her that the workers involved in turning shingles into diesel fuel would be working with toxic chemicals in extremely hazardous conditions? Unfortunately for those workers and the neighbors near the toxic plant in Marengo, Reynolds and her staff at the Iowa Department of Natural Resources ignored the EPA's warnings, including the fact that the scofflaw company was being run out of two other states with its toxic shingles to diesel operation. Instead of heeding this credible warning and stopping this shady actor from setting up shop in Iowa, the governor allowed C60 to operate without a permit and with virtually no worker or environmental protections. In fact, instead of complying with regulators' basic requests for information about its operation, C60 knew how to play the game in Iowa. They hired a well-connected lobbyist and former chief of staff to the Governor Terry Branstad Reynolds administration to run interference with state officials on their so that their toxic business could operate unimpeded. C60's strategy paid off long enough to expose their workers to toxic levels of deadly workplace poisons and cause an explosion and fire that sent 20 people to the hospital, some with life-threatening injuries. That fire destroyed more than $600,000 in local fire and emergency response equipment and created a polluted site that will cost millions to clean up for years to come. Adding insult to injury, in the aftermath of that December 6th explosion and fire, Reynolds rushed in with the checkbook and rewarded C60's negligence with $1.3 million in taxpayer funds to help clean up the mess that they caused. There is some good news, though. The EPA has taken control of the investigation and the cleanup of the site from the Reynolds operation. They will have their work cut out for them, holding this company financially liable for the cleanup of cancer-causing chemicals and contaminated soil at this new Superfund site. Reynolds needs to be held accountable for the human and environmental harm she allowed to happen in Iowa County. C60 owners should be held criminally liable for their complete disregard for the health and safety of people in Marengo and for failing to tell their employees and local fire and emergency responders what chemicals were being used at the plant. The chemical exposures have left former plant workers sick and vulnerable to cancer and life-shortening illnesses. C60 should be required to pay for medical monitoring and any health care bills for years to come for all their former employees and 100% of the cleanup costs for their toxic mess. When Reynolds stops in Iowa County on her 99-county tour, she should meet with injured workers, emergency responders, and their families. She can update them on all the ways her Republican administration has promoted low-wage rural jobs and reduced worker safety and environmental regulations. That's a guest editorial from Joe Bolcom, a former Democratic state senator from Iowa City. We have a couple community letters today. The first one's from Jay Cassina of Marion, who says, a recent letter here asked, who knew that electing Obama and Biden would lead to this level of consequences? Here's your answer. Millions of people, mostly Republicans, and lots of independents who didn't agree that America needed fundamental change. So listen up, Mr. Nobody Told Me. Let the progressives succeed in their effort to take over the Supreme Court, and you can change one more thing. You can change the name of our country to the former United States of America. And that's a community letter from Jay Cassina of Marion. The other letter is from Jerry Elsie of Cedar Rapids, who says, 2 years ago, the Gazette ran my fanciful guest column called Planning for Felon as President. It was a playful poke at most Republicans' preference for a crooked Donald Trump over the most law-abiding Democrat. It envisioned a re-elected Trump operating behind bars. Well, last week, with the former president remaining the GOP's runaway favorite for the nomination, a former Trump attorney predicted he will go to jail. With that, I asked that the Gazette records keeper move my 2021 guest commentary because Trump has killed satire. And that's a community letter from Jerry Elsie of Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Let's start today with the shorter death notices, but there's only one of those today from Delhi. Velva Mae Wilson, age 92, died Wednesday, May 24th. The Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Manchester is in charge of those arrangements. Now to the longer, more detailed obituaries. Alexander William Glover, age 21, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, May 20th from a drowning accident on Lake Okoboji. Services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, June 3rd at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 2nd at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Kyle M. Walker, age 20, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, May 24th. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch-Linwood in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Gary Raymond Anderson, age 78, of Van Horn, passed away on Monday, May 22nd, at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, June 6th at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Rest Haven. Memorial contributions may be made in Gary's name to the Oldorf Hospice House or the Mark Harrison Foundation in Shellsburg. Denise Lynn Moore, age 62, of Iowa City, passed away at her home in the early hours of Friday, May 19th, surrounded by her family. Denise's passing was due to complications related to treatment in her courageous battle with pancreatic cancer. Private services have been held. A celebration of life for family and friends will be held this summer, with details to be shared by her family. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Denise in Denise's name to Vive for Therapy of Dubuque. That address is 4855 Ashbury Road, number 7 in Dubuque, 52002, where donations will be used to offset costs for other patients with cancer receiving intravenous vitamin C. Charlotte Ellen Lesline, age 98, formerly of Manchester, the past 4 years of an independent living facility in Jacksonville, Florida, died surrounded with loving family and hospice care on May 22nd. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 Wednesday morning, May 31st, at the First Evangelical Lutheran Church in Manchester, with the Reverend Tony Eady officiating. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may also call from 9 to 10:15 a.m. at the church on Wednesday. Catherine P. Walford, age 95, of Brooklyn, passed away Tuesday, May 23rd, at the Brooklyn Community Estate. A memorial mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 Wednesday morning, May 31st, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Brooklyn, with Father Scott LeMaster officiating. Visitation will be from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th, with a rosary recited at 3:30 p.m. at the Closter Funeral Home of Brooklyn. Interment will be in the Brooklyn Memorial Cemetery. A memorial fund has been established. Linda R. Fincham, age 85, of Iowa City, passed away Wednesday, May 17th, after a sudden illness. A service will be held at St. Andrew Presbyterian Church at 140 Gathering Place Lane in Iowa City on June 23rd at 5 p.m., with a celebration of life to follow. Linda will join Dick in a private family event at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to University Heights Community Fund, Community Foundation of Johnson County, or a charity of your choice. Wanda Jane Keck, age 95, of Colesburg, passed away on Wednesday, May 24th, at the Edgewood Convalescent Home in Edgewood, surrounded by her family. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 Wednesday morning, May 31st, at the Colesburg Methodist Church, with Pastor Kathy Remke officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Edgewood. Friends may also call an hour before the service at the church on Wednesday. Arla Jean Beers, age 93, of Delmar, passed away peacefully on Thursday morning, May 18th, at the Woodlands in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of her life will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 31st, at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. A visitation will be held prior to the funeral from 10 to 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Delmar. From Mohammed, Illinois, Joseph V. Cassano died on May 19th. Per his request, no service will be held. In lieu of service viewing, feel free to donate to the Vietnam Veterans of America. Carolyn C. Peters, age 89, of Marion, formerly of Charles City, passed away Tuesday, May 23rd. Funeral services will be held at 2:30 Saturday afternoon, May 27th, at Bethany Alliance Church in Charles City, with Pastor Colton Page officiating. Burial will be in the Riverside Cemetery in Charles City. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service on Saturday at the church. The Hauser Weishar Funeral Home of Charles City is in charge of local arrangements. And Spencer R. Laffler, age 30, of Waterloo, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, May 23rd at Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th at the Bronx Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. A celebration of life services will be held at 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, May 31st at the Bronx Chapel. Now we move on to the sports page, where there's a story on the sideline about high school golf. Jane Peterson of Cedar Rapids, Washington, carded a 68 and leads the Class 4A field after one round of the state tournament Thursday at Otter Creek Golf Course in Ankeny. The Warriors, as a team, are in second place, 6 shots behind Pleasant Valley. 2 shots back in the 4A individual race is Linmar's Morgan Rupp, and Addie Berg of Cedar Rapids Prairie is 7th at 2 over. Mihar Julka of Cedar Rapids Xavier and Kaylin Long of Washington, Iowa, are tied for 3rd in the 3A tournament at the Pheasant Ridge Golf Course in Cedar Falls. Xavier is 5th there as a team. As far as college golf, Kirkwood remains on top after the third round Thursday at the NJCAA Division II Championships at Swan Lake Resort in Plymouth, Indiana. Kirkwood carded a 6 over 294 Thursday and sits at 5 over after 3 rounds, 10 shots ahead of second place Parkland and Mississippi Gulf Coast. Colby Shackelford is the top individual for the Eagles, tied for first with 5 other players. As far as college softball locally, Kirkwood was eliminated at the Division II World Series on Thursday, losing to Parkland 10-2 in a game that ended in the 6th inning at the Tiger River Park in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Kirkwood finished 45-18 and was limited to 4 hits, 2 of them by Emily Linder. For boys tennis, pairings have been released for the boys' state team tennis tournament May 31st to June 1st. Waukee Northwest is hosting the Class 2A meet, and Class 1A teams will play at the Hawkeye Tennis and Recreation Center in Iowa City. This is the first year for a 2-day, 8-team state tournament. Iowa City West, Lynn Mar, and Cedar Rapids Washington are in the 2A field, while Cedar Rapids Xavier and Decorah are in the 1A draw. To expand a little bit on that tennis story, we have a story written by Mike Condon. Washington duo set to defend crown. Dateline Cedar Rapids. They're the defending state Class 2A doubles champions and have had a stellar season. So, it would be reasonable to assume that Cedar Rapids Washington's Caitlin Cock and Catherine Zylstra would have the number one seed entering this weekend's state tournament. Guess again. Although Cock and Zylstra compiled an impressive record, the one blemish on their season came May 2nd in a dual meet with Cedar Falls when they dropped a decision to the Tiger duel of Maya Malavarupo and Madison Sagers. So, when the state seedings came out, that Cedar Falls pair got the top seed. Washington coach Nina Marquardt said, "Oh, it has been a motivation for them. This is their last run together, and they want to come out on top." Cock and Zylstra's quest to defend their 2A title begins at 10 o'clock today at the Hawkeye Tennis and Rec Center. The 1A tournament is being held at Burns Park in Waterloo. Consolation play Saturday starts at 9:30, with semifinals at 10 and the finals at 12:30. Cock is a junior and said the loss to Malavarapu and Sagers was a sign to her that Zylstra that the road to a repeat was not just a given. She said, "Obviously, that was a very tough loss for us. It was kind of a wake-up call. It gave us more motivation than ever. I think if we would have won that match, we would have gone into practice thinking we could just win. Now, we have those doubts in our minds, pushing us even further on the court to improve." The two teams have a history of close matches. They played in the team tournament last year with the Washington pair winning 7-6, 7-5. Cox said, "Maya and Maddie have been playing tennis for a long time. I've seen them in tournaments since I was 12, and they know their way around the court. They have a pretty solid mental game." Cock and Zylstra won the 2022 title as the number 2 seed, knocking off West Des Moines Dowling's Mackenzie Klein and Ava Peterson in the final. Zylstra and Cock have played together for 3 seasons. Zylstra's career ends after next week's team tournament. She's elected not to play collegiately. She says she's looking forward to her last couple events with Cock. "I'm sure the emotion," she said, "will be running pretty high. I'm honestly going in with the attitude of trying to enjoy every moment." Cock and Zylstra were to be joined in the 2A doubles field by teammates Maya Messenger and Lily Bell Barker, but they had to withdraw. Both also are members of the Warriors golf team, which is playing at state. The duel's been replaced by Jefferson's Allie Barlow and Olivia Young, the third-place finisher in regional play. Other area doubles teams in the field come from Iowa City West and Lynn Mar. Both West and Jefferson have 2 players in the 2A singles draw, Juliana Mescardo and Mohana Sankara represent the Trojans, while Lily Holland and Lily Schreckengast, the Jayhawks. In Class 1A, Xavier's Avery Link is the number 3 single seed, while teammate Allie Schulman is the singles draw, as is Decorah's Yvonne Lights. Xavier's Haley Gossman and Annalise Schragi are the number 3 double seed. Marion's Michaela Goad and Natalie Hartman are 4th. Xavier's Ruby Smith and Isabel Tobin are also in that draw. As far as high school boys soccer, here's a story written by Nathan Ford of the Gazette. The 2023 Iowa High School Boys State Soccer Tournament field is now set. Here's a look at the sub-state finals from Wednesday night that involved area teams. Number 5 Cedar Rapids Prairie and number 2 or rather, number 9, Pleasant Valley, Prairie won 2-1. Number 6, Iowa City West, beat number 16, Dubuque Senior, 9-3. Number 10, Cedar Rapids Kennedy, defeated number 15, Iowa City High, 2-1. in Class 3A. Number 3, Marion, beat North Scott 3-0, while number 9, Iowa City Liberty, beat number 15, Fort Madison 10-0. Cedar Rapids Xavier beat number 11, Carlisle, in overtime 3-2. In Class 2A, number 11, Center Point Urbana, nipped number 9, Decorah, in overtime 1-0. Number 1, Gilbert, defeated number 10, Williamsburg, 3-1. In Class 1A, number 2, Iowa City Regina, beat Dyersville-Beckman, 8-0. Number 5, West Liberty, beat number 15, Mediapolis, 5-0. Number 2, West Branch, beat Pella Christian, 2-1 in overtime. The state tournament starts Tuesday with the quarterfinals at County Soccer Park in Des Moines. Semifinals are Thursday, and the championship games are Saturday, June 3rd. In the 1A state pairings on Tuesday in the quarterfinals in Class 1A, West Branch will take on Des Moines Christian, while West Liberty will take on Iowa City Regina. In Class 2A, as far as local teams are involved, there is Center Point Urbana playing Sioux City Helin. In Class 3A, Cedar Rapids Xavier's first-round opponent will be Des Moines Hoover, while Iowa City Liberty will go up against Dallas Center Grimes, and Marion will take on Denison Schleswig. In the 4A quarterfinals, it will be Cedar Rapids Prairie against Johnston. Iowa City West will take on Cedar Rapids Kennedy. And the high school baseball and softball seasons are underway, and we do have one score from softball from yesterday. Cedar Rapids Kennedy defeated Dubuque Waller 10-1. Here's a feature on high school baseball written by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette that says, Linmar's Mishler continues big week. Dateline, Iowa City. Jackson Mishler met with Linmar coach Kyle Rodenkirk and his staff after the season's first week. Coaches challenged him to play loose, alleviate self-imposed pressure, and enjoy his junior season. Challenge accepted and met. Mishler appeared comfortable at the plate and in the field Wednesday, collecting 4 hits and 6 RBI and helping the Lions to a baseball doubleheader sweep of Iowa City West, 7-1 and 10-4. Then, add a win over Clinton, and Mishler has 6 hits and 11 RBI in his last 3 games. Mishler said, "This week I've had so much fun. These guys are so fun to play with. I'm playing relaxed and loose. That is what all my youth coaches taught me, and I think I really did that this week. It shows." Mishler is leading Linmar with a .391 batting average and has already doubled his production from last week. He heard his coaches and applied the advice and said, "I had a tough week. I came back this week locked in, ready to go." Rodenkirk said Mishler has been consistent at shortstop, claiming his defense prevented about 4 runs in that 13-9 victory at Clinton. He made 14 of 15 total chances, including a highlight reel diving catch down the left field line in the nightcap. Which is more exciting, offensive production or laying out on defense? Mishler said, "Definitely the catch. It's so fun to make a play for the team. Everyone can hit, but it's so fun to make a play, especially when our pitchers are dealing." The biggest change has been at the plate. Mishler said he has dedicated time in practice hitting to the right side and working up the middle. One effort has paid dividends for one of the Lions' captain. Rodenkirk said, "He's a staple for us. It's good to see the hard work offensively paying off for him. He was pretty hard on himself the first week. Just happy to see kids produce with as hard as they work in the off season." He said, "Great kid. Great family, and I'm happy to see him have some success. It's fun to get games like that." Moving to the top stories page, we see a story of statewide interest, but with local interest as well, written by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Headline says, "Farm groups seek stronger safety net in upcoming farm bill." Iowa farm groups and congressional representatives said a strong safety net for farmers is vital as Congress works to reauthorize the federal farm bill this year. Increasing baseline funding for programs like crop insurance that help cover losses from natural disasters or low revenue would help farmers deal with high production costs and uncertain futures. That's according to Iowa Farm Bureau Federation President Brent Johnson. The federal farm bill is a sprawling legislative package reauthorized every 5 years that deals with farming, rural development, nutrition, conservation, forestry, and more. It lays out several key farm programs like the safety net programs as well as ag research and nutrition assistance. It was last passed in 2018 and will need to pass by fall of this year to keep certain programs functioning. Production and input costs have increased significantly since 2020, Johnson said, with some steeply outpacing inflation. He said, "The cost of production right now is higher than our expected revenue come this fall, and to deal with 200% to 300% inflation, knowing that our cash flows are upside down currently, that puts real risk into communities." Aaron Lehman is president of the Iowa Farmers Union. He echoed that the call for an updated safety net is needed. He also said the farm bill should address consolidation in the farming industry, and he attributed some of the increase in production costs to consolidation on both the input side and the markets that farmers sell to. He said, "We think that this farm bill ought to include a competition title so that these marketplaces are transparent and they deal with supply and demand forces rather than price manipulations that may be taking place." In political news, a story written by the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's planning a trip here. Now that he's announced his bid for the White House, Ron DeSantis has planned campaign events in 3 early voting states, including Iowa. He'll return to Iowa for events next Tuesday and Wednesday. He'll hold a campaign kickoff event Tuesday in Des Moines, then will hold events Wednesday in Sioux City, Council Bluffs, Pella, and Cedar Rapids. Then he's scheduled to hold 4 events in New Hampshire and South Carolina. Meanwhile, Grandview University in Des Moines is scheduled to host a pair of town halls broadcast live by CNN with Republican presidential hopefuls Nikki Haley and Mike Pence. Haley's will be on June the 4th, Pence's will be on June the 7th. Collins Aerospace is in the news today, a story written by the Gazette that is headlined, "Collins Aerospace touts 2 in-flight internet wins." Collins Aerospace of Cedar Rapids has launched a new cost-effective internet connection for use in business jets that will keep passengers connected while in the air. The Collins Aerospace IRTNX satellite communication system for Iridium Certus 700 is among the first certified connected cabin hardware and service solutions that can be installed and operated globally on a variety of aircraft. It also reduces overall connectivity costs by up to 50%, according to a news release from Raytheon Technologies, which is the parent company of Collins Aerospace, the largest private employer in Cedar Rapids. The company this week also announced a plan to bring unlimited data to the customers of Vista, which is a private aviation group. Using Collins LuxStream, which runs on the SES High Throughput Satellite Network, Vista customers will get fast, reliable, and unlimited internet access during their flights. Since 2019, the Dubai-based Vista has installed LuxStream on more than 75 aircraft in its business fleet. The system now will be installed on more than 100 aircraft. According to Jen Schopfer, the president of Connected Aviation Solutions at Collins Aerospace, our relationship with Vista and SES deliver exceptional in-flight connectivity experiences to customers. A flat hourly rate for global Wi-Fi is a market first. On the business page, there's a story written by Isabella Saluska of the Gazette, "Chipotle to build a Coralville location." Dateline, Coralville. Cravings for Chipotle burrito bowls, chips, and guacamole will be easier to satisfy when a drive-through location opens up on Coralville's north side. The proposed location is at 3260 Red Hawk Street, just off Coral Ridge Avenue next to Red Hawk Dental Care, and across the street from Jersey Mike's Subs and Foundry Food and Tap. The restaurant will offer online order pickups only, with no on-site ordering. The Coralville City Council this week gave first approval to rezoning for the standalone building, with two more approvals required before the rezoning is final. It's a 2,337-square-foot restaurant that will sit on 1.88 acres with 30 parking spaces, a bike rack, and an outdoor patio on the east side of the building. Chipotle restaurants now operate in downtown Iowa City and at the Lindale Mall in Cedar Rapids. And our final story from the business page, the Central Iowa Power Cooperative this week named Andrew St. John as the cooperative's next CEO and executive vice president. He will begin his new job June 5th, following the retirement of Bill Cherrier. Over the past 7 years, Andrew has demonstrated exceptional leadership and strategic planning abilities as vice president and CFO. That's according to SIPCO board president Paul Heineman. We're pleased to promote a cooperative leader familiar with SIPCO's member owners, power supply, portfolio, and our strategic partners. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 26th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.